20 years ago, Darrell Henley was playing in the defensive secondary for the Rams. The team wasn't especially good, but Henley's prospects were excellent until he got involved with a collection of people who were transporting and selling cocaine. In Intercepted, subtitled The Rise and Fall of NFL Cornerback Darrell Henley, Michael McKnight tells the story of Henley's sudden fall from celebrity and wealth into a federal penitentiary. The author joins me from NPR West. Michael, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill, very much.
In 1993, Darrell Henley had realized his unlikely dream. He was small. He only weighed 170 pounds. Nevertheless, he had established himself in the National Football League. His future must have looked pretty good, right?
It looked very good. He embraced the idea of film study and knowing his craft and knowing his opponent, and that's really what he staked his career on. It wasn't he was certainly physically talented, but he was exceptionally bright, and he built a career on that. He built a standing as a starting NFL defensive back based on that, and his career was on the upswing. His next contract was going to be a very, very lucrative one for him.
All these advantages and the great promise of his career notwithstanding, you write, Henley apparently sought a chance to be part of something countercultural, illicit, and risky. Why? Did you get a sense of why?
I did, and not to condone anything that Darrell did, but the society and the zeitgeist of that time is worthy of, you know, a little bit of discussion, and that gangster rap and the idea of maybe being a little bit more street than one really is was an attractive part of our culture. And Darrell Henley, you know, was gently made fun of by his teammates and his friends growing up. He was kind of a square. He was green. You know, you're not from downtown Los Angeles. You're not from South Central. You're from, you know, Ontario. It's kind of a, if you'll pardon the phrase, kind of a white bread part of Los Angeles' suburbs. So to answer your question, Bill, it was a dreadful, dreadful mistake that he spent the next 3 years trying to crawl his way out of. And in fact, it got deeper and deeper.
What he got deeper and deeper into was the transporting of cocaine from one part of the country to another. Tell me a little bit about how he got involved in that specifically.
Sure. Darrell was in his fourth year in the NFL. It was 1993. And he met a cheerleader for the Rams named Tracy Donahoe. She was 19 years old, a white young lady from Orange County, which is a very affluent part of the Los Angeles metroplex south of Los Angeles. So he met her. They became romantically involved. Nothing illicit or illegal was going on between them until around May, he encountered a friend of his from the neighborhood named Willie McGowan, who was the youth sports star, the golden child of the neighborhood where Darrell grew up. And Willie's athletic career had since faded, and he had turned to drug trafficking. He presented him with an opportunity to basically, Darrell, I have a chance to move a suitcase from Los Angeles to the East Coast, in this case Memphis, in the off chance that something should go wrong here. I'm going to need someone to kind of bail me out. It's insurance, a guarantee, as it were. And Darrell said, I can help you out if something goes wrong. And that was an awful step, and certainly it was a foolish step to take.
The person actually caught carrying cocaine through an airport was that Rams cheerleader, Tracy Donahoe, with whom Henley had had a relationship. Donahoe is white, Henley is black. How much did that impact the way the two defendants were treated and where they ended up?
Well, therein lies one of the most fascinating parts of the story, I believe, is that you know, Darrell Henley's trial and his story, in fact, were overshadowed by the O.J. Simpson trial, which was held concurrently in Los Angeles County while Darrell stood trial in Orange County. So it's often been said that Darrell's trial was a photo negative of O.J. Simpson's trial. Darrell Henley, his verdict was delivered by a jury of 10 white people and 2 black people. That's almost the exact opposite of O.J. Simpson's. So race did play a role in the proceedings, but kind of a latent one, and that you know, you and I and everyone else were so glued to the O.J. Simpson trial that really we had never heard of Darrell Henley. We didn't even know that this was happening.
I'm speaking with Michael McKnight, the author of Intercepted, The Rise and Fall of NFL Cornerback Darrell Henley, and you're listening to Only a Game. Serious as Henley's drug-related conviction was, he would probably be out of jail by now if he hadn't also been convicted in connection with a conspiracy to murder the trial judge. How did that come to pass?
Daryl Henley and his four co-defendants, they had a very, very strong motion for a new trial. There was one juror who abused methamphetamine during the trial. There was another juror who was found to have smoked marijuana to and from court during the trial. There was a third juror. This juror was found to have used the N-word in describing the defendants throughout the trial. About a year after the verdict was delivered, Daryl Henley is still incarcerated in MDC, this high-rise prison in downtown Los Angeles. He was a defendant who was, you know, dangerously angry at the system that he thought had given him an unfair shake in court. And, you know, he ended up agreeing to the unthinkable, which is, you know, taking two lives.
I'm curious about your motivation for writing Intercepted, which, as I understand it, required 8 years of research. Did you initially feel that Daryl Henley had not gotten a fair trial?
I initially, Bill, I came across this story when I was a student at the University of Florida in the early 90s, and my roommate and I can still picture it vividly, came across a newspaper story about this NFL cornerback who was accused of running a large-scale cocaine trafficking ring. Idiot 19-year-olds that we were, we thought it was, you know, super cool. We thought it was, you know, Scarface meets Deion Sanders. This is the coolest thing ever. But I came to learn that it was, in fact, not very cool at all, and that it, you know, led to irreparable damage to the people that he loved the most. Daryl Henley is not a victim, and he will tell you as much if he were on the phone with you right now. He is not a victim. His parents and his family are the victims here, and he still kicks himself daily for the pain and the hurt, the financial ruin, the embarrassment that he has brought them. It's also worth adding that the Henley family today is very, very close, and he is incarcerated in Texas, very near his family, and they visit him every week, every other week. So it bears mentioning that they've endured through this.
Michael McKnight is the author of Intercepted, The Rise and Fall of NFL Cornerback Daryl Henley. The book is published by University of Nebraska Press, and the author joined me from NPR West. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like pizza from Italy and cheddar from Australia. Locations at TraderJoe's.com. This is NPR.
Nobody expected Texas A&M to beat Alabama last Saturday, or at least an A&M student who chooses to be identified only as Calvin N. didn't expect that to happen, which is why he entered into a bet that would require him to have the final score tattooed on his butt should A&M prevail. When he woke up on Sunday, Calvin wondered why his rear end was so sore, and then he remembered precisely why. Calvin is a business major, and he said earlier this week, "I'm not sure how the ass tattoo will sound at job interviews." "I'm not sure about that either, Calvin, and I'm also not entirely sure why the tattoo would come up in that context."
"Because I've got you under my skin."